Target Steel, sixth in the Electrifying Steel series by J.D. Masters. For John Kennedy, friend, critic, sometime collaborator, and occasional pain in the asterisk percent sign, pound sign, at sign. Prologue. Linda Tellerman, reporter and co-anchor for Channel 7, Eyewitness News, parked her car in a dark, garbage-strewn area not far from the intersection of West and Perry Streets. Her cameraman, Andy Steinberg, sat nervously beside her, glancing out through the bulletproof windows.
"This is not a good idea," he said,
unsnapping the safety strap on his cross-draw hip holster. It held a double-action .45 semi-automatic pistol. In the open Kudura bag on the floor at his feet, the grip of a 9mm machine pistol was exposed. In addition to spare videotape and tools, the bag also held several extended magazines, holding 50 9mm rounds apiece. Linda sat back, letting the car idle, and lit a cigarette. They were both wearing bright blue jumpsuits with the station logo emblazoned on their backs, as well as on their sleeves and over their left breast pockets. Combat dress, Linda liked to call it, what the news crews always wore when they went out to cover a hot spot, like a riot or a police action in a no-man's land, so that law enforcement officers could readily identify them and refrain from shooting them by mistake. There were times when the police wished that the media did not so obligingly identify themselves. They both knew that there were more than a few policemen who wouldn't mind at all if a TV news reporter happened to catch a stray bullet.
"You gonna tell me what the hell we're doing here?" asked Andy.
"We're supposed to meet someone," said Linda, exhaling a long stream of cigarette smoke. She seemed tense.
"I figured that much out," he said wryly.
Linda said nothing. She glanced at her watch and bit her lower lip nervously.
"Damn it, Linda! How long have we been working together?"
She didn't turn toward him. She continued to stare straight ahead through the bulletproof windshield.
"About 4 years," she said.
"Well, don't you think that after the 4 years of mutual trust and cooperation, you at least owe me an explanation? What the hell is all the goddamned mystery about?"
he said.
"This isn't like you!"
"I'm sorry, Andy," she said, "but I gave my word I wouldn't let anyone know where I was going."
"But I'm already here with you,"
Andy protested. She glanced at her watch again, then turned to look at him.
"We're meeting Steel."
"Holy shit,"
said Andy. He took a deep breath and let it out slowly.
"Do you know what the hell you're doing?"
"I think so."
"I hope to God you do,"
said Andy, shaking his head.
"We've got enough ordnance here to waste a screamer or two and maybe back off and attack my gang members. But there's no way in hell we'll be able to handle a crazy cyborg."
"The thing is, I don't think he's crazy,"
Linda said, staring straight ahead once more.
"No, they've got the Metro Police and Strike Force and Federal Marshals combing the entire city for him because he didn't pay a parking ticket,"
Andy said dryly.
"I don't think he's crazy," Linda repeated. "He sounded perfectly rational when I spoke to him."
"Oh, great," said Andy. "You're trained to make that kind of diagnosis over the phone, are you?"
"He said he's been framed. He wants to tell us his side of the story," Linda replied. "What was I supposed to do? Ignore him? There's no way I could pass up an opportunity like this. He's news, Andy. Besides, why would he want to do anything to hurt us? What would he stand to gain?"
"If his computer brain's gone haywire, who knows what the hell he's thinking?"
Andy said.
"Jesus, I still remember what happened when that other cyborg ran amok. How many people did he kill before they stopped him? A couple dozen or more? What about that firefight Steele got into with the federal marshals the other day? 5 men were killed."
"We don't really know what happened, Andy," Linda insisted. "We weren't there. Knowing the marshals, they probably started shooting first. Steele might have had no other choice. Besides, according to witnesses, the men who died were shot by whoever was in that gypsy cab that helped Steele get away. My guess is it was ICE."
"Great! So that makes it okay. ICE is almost as dangerous as Steel. Anyway, those same witnesses also said that Steel was firing at the feds. So maybe it was ICE who killed those men. Maybe it was Steel. What the hell's the difference? They turned the street into a goddamn war zone. It's amazing more people weren't killed. Jesus, I wish you told me about this earlier.
Why? You mean you wouldn't have come? He sighed.
Hell, I don't know. We've taken some chances in the past, but this is really crazy. Why are we sticking our necks out like this? What's the point?
The point is that we're trying to get a story, Andy, she replied. That's our job, remember? Besides, somebody owes that man a chance to have his say. After all he's done for the people of this city, he at least deserves an opportunity to respond to the charges against him. I intend to see that he gets it.
And I suppose the ratings have nothing to do with it,
said Andy Riley. You want to keep your job, Andy? She said, staring out through the windshield. He glanced at her sharply.
Yeah, I want to keep my job.
Then shut the fuck up.
They sat in tense silence for a few minutes. Linda lit up another cigarette. She's scared, Andy thought uneasily, really wound up tight. He'd never seen her like this. In the 4 years they'd been together, they'd covered some pretty hazardous situations, and Linda always kept her cool. She didn't frighten easily. But she seemed frightened now. Andy felt exposed. It was a desolate, deserted section of the city. Trash was strewn all over the place. About 15 yards away was a spot where someone had built an open fire. Behind them, the rusted-out hulk of a long-abandoned automobile sat on its axles, the glass of its windows broken. An uprooted parking sign rammed through the windshield. The rusted body was shot through with bullet holes and covered with graffiti. There were shadows all around them, plenty of places for screamers and homicidal derelicts to hide. Great place to meet someone, thought Andy. Especially someone who's half man and half machine, with a computer for a brain. A brain that, according to the authorities, had malfunctioned and driven Steele insane.
There he is, Linda said suddenly. She sat up straight, rigid. Get your rig and get ready to roll.
She tossed her cigarette out the window and got out of the car.
Shit,
said Andy. He grabbed for the machine pistol, then grimaced and put it back in the bag.
Hell, if I shoot him with that thing, it'll only make him mad.
He rolled his eyes skyward, took a deep breath, got out of the car, and shouldered his rig.
I knew I should have gone into some other line of work,
he mumbled to himself with resignation. Donovan Steele came toward them. There was someone behind him cradling an assault rifle. As they came closer, Andy noticed that it was a young woman. That would be Raven, he thought. Steele's lady. A damn good-looking piece, he thought. In her early 20s, short black hair, slim figure, incredible legs. She was wearing black high-heeled boots, a black leather miniskirt, and a crimson halter top. Child woman face? Sure. Cute but hard-looking. He'd heard she used to be a hooker. She was holding that assault rifle like she knew how to use it, too. Well, if she's safe with him, maybe he really hasn't gone amok, thought Andy. On the other hand, who knew? He would, in about 10 seconds.
You're late, said Linda, tensely.
Sorry! I had to make certain you weren't followed, Steele said.
He was a tall, brawny-looking man, ruggedly handsome, with thick black hair and light slate-gray eyes. But Andy knew that they weren't really eyes. They were bionic optic units equipped with image intensifiers and both infrared and laser-designated systems tied into his cybernetic brain. To look at him, Steele appeared perfectly normal. He looked like a cop, which is what he had been, a lieutenant in the Special Operations Division of the NYPD, more commonly known as Strike Force. Police commandos tasked to keep the no-man's-land bordering Midtown pacified, or at least to keep the poor bastards trying to scratch out an existence there from overrunning Midtown. Andy knew a lot about Steele because Linda had been the one to break the story when Steele had been turned into a cyborg. Since then, the story had been widely reported, both in print and on TV. It began when Lieutenant Donovan Steele had been assigned by his chief, Captain Jake Hardesty, to participate in a series of classified experiments conducted under the auspices of the CIA in their lab complex at the Federal Building, which had once been the United Nations and was now the seat of government of what was left of the United States. The aim of Project Download had been to perfect brain-computer interface, the transmission of data and images via biochip from the human brain to a computer, and vice versa. Given the drastic shortage of trained personnel since the war, it was seen as the hope of dramatic progress for humanity, but it was highly controversial. After being permanently implanted with a biochip and participating in a series of experiments, Steele had been shot down in the performance of his duties by assassins of the Borodini crime family. They had used some serious ordnance. Steele had been riddled with armor-piercing bullets, against which his police flak vest had been little more than useless, and trapped inside a burning building. By the time they pulled him out, there hadn't been much left of him. He was still alive, miraculously, but he was in a coma with irreparable brain damage. The best the hospital could do for him was to keep him alive on life support machinery, but he was a vegetable. However, the scientists at Project Download were able to do considerably more. In their top secret laboratories, they went to work rebuilding his body with high-tech, fusion-powered Nysteel alloy prosthetics. In the meantime, a team of cybernetics engineers accessed the still-functioning biochip implanted in his brain and downloaded what was left of his mind into a computer, where his personality was reconstructed with mental engrams they had downloaded from him previously during their experiments, as well as with supplementary engram data drawn from other test subjects. The engram matrix that was Steele's identity was tested and debugged in the project computers, then loaded into an experimental cybernetic brain that was used to replace his damaged human brain. Steele then came to life as the first cyborg in history, part man and part machine. Outwardly, he looked perfectly normal, but both his arms and legs were now Nysteel prosthetics, possessing incredible power and strength, and equipped with scores of biosensors that gave him normal human feeling in his limbs, or at least something that approximated normal human feeling. He still had most of his human organs, and it was blood that ran through his veins, not motor oil. But Steele's brain was a computer, and he was equipped with formidable built-in weapon systems. Much of his burned flesh had been replaced with a synthetic polymer skin that was highly resistant to bullets, and his skeletal system had been extensively reinforced with articulated Nysteel. The actual details of his construction were classified, but Andy knew that Steele had a compensated 10mm pistol built into his right forearm, with a sophisticated polymer ceramic firing mechanism slaved to his brain, and a barrel that extruded through a gun port in his palm. His left arm contained a high-powered carbon laser, and the team that built him had also equipped him with a number of auxiliary battle mods, modular attachments of various sorts, from tools to weapons, that could take the place of his human-looking hands, which could detach. In short, he was a lethal juggernaut. The idea had been to use him as a prototype and send him out on strike force duty with his fellow officers as part of a field testing procedure. If he performed up to expectations, and Steele had exceeded them, the plan had been to construct more cyborgs so that eventually every urban police force could be equipped with at least one. There was also a plan to construct a slightly different, more advanced series of cyborgs for the military. However, those plans were shelved when the second cyborg, codenamed Stalker, the first of the advanced military series, had malfunctioned and undergone an electronic psychosis. He had run amok in the city on a murderous spree until Steele had finally stopped him, but not before a lot of lives were lost. After that, Senator Bryce Carman had ramrodded new legislation through Congress, outlawing the construction of any more cyborgs. It was, Carman maintained, dangerous and controversial, a blasphemous technology that had frightening implications for the future of the human race. In the aftermath of Stalker's reign of terror, few people disagreed with him. Now it seemed that the same malady that had struck Stalker had befallen Steele, and they were alone with him in a deserted section of the city, with nothing to protect them if Steele went crazy and attacked. Linda did not believe that Steele was crazy. Frankly, Andy wasn't sure that Linda was entirely sane herself.
"What's the matter?" Linda asked Steele. "Don't you trust me? Did you think I'd bring the police with me?"
"No, I didn't, but there was a possibility that you might have been followed," Steele said.
"Why would they want to follow me?" she asked.
"Because we know each other. Carman will probably expect me to try and get my version of the story out. He can't afford to let that happen."
"Senator Carman?" Linda asked, frowning. "You're talking as if he's got something to hide."
"Believe it, lady," Steele said.
"Like what?"
"Like murder for openers."
Her eyes widened.
"You're accusing Senator Bryce Carman of murder?"
"Not directly," Steele replied. "To my knowledge, he didn't personally kill anyone, but he ordered it done. And he knows that I know about it. That's why he's put out the story that I've gone insane and given orders that I be shot on sight."
"Can you prove any of this?" she said.
"Unfortunately, no," said Steele. "At least, not yet. It's only my word against his. I can't prove that I'm telling you, but on the other hand, I can sure as hell raise a lot of questions he's not going to like answering."
Christ, wait a minute. I've got to get this down on tape, she said. Steel smiled wryly.
That was the general idea.
Andy, you ready?
Rolling,
Andy said. She held up her microphone and stood facing the minicam. This is Linda Tellerman. I'm standing here in this desolate section of the city somewhere on the west side, bringing you a story concerning someone who at this very moment is the object of the largest manhunt this city has ever seen. Metro Police, Strike Force, and Federal Marshals have all been mobilized to hunt him down, with orders to shoot him on sight. Donovan Steele, we are told, has gone insane, the victim of a malfunctioning computer brain. Like the cyborg known as Stalker, we are told that Steele has run amok, that he has become a murderous psychotic, posing a grave threat to the people of this city. But there are two sides to every story, and I am here to bring you this. Earlier today, Steele contacted me to arrange a secret meeting, and I am now standing here beside this allegedly psychotic cyborg, safe and unharmed, with news of some startling allegations.
Andy widened the shot to include Steele as Linda turned to him and held the mic in front of his face.
Lieutenant Steele, as we stand here, you seem perfectly rational to me. You claim that you are not an insane killer, and I certainly don't see any evidence of your alleged malfunctions. To what, then, do you attribute this citywide manhunt for you?
To the fact that I'm being framed for political reasons, Steele replied.
Framed, you say? By whom?
By Senator Bryce Carman!
That's a very serious accusation, she said. If it's true, then what reason would a man of Senator Carman's impeccable reputation have for framing you, as you put it?
Bryce Carman has gone on record numerous times as being against the whole idea of cyborgs, Steele said. He has also gone on record as being against the Central Intelligence Agency. Carman has long believed that the agency has outlived its usefulness, and he has always been against the idea of the agency being in control of Project Download, as well as its subsidiary, Project Steele, which is yours truly.
That hardly seems like sufficient reason to have you framed for murder, Linda said.
No, that's only part of it, said Steele. Carman wanted to take Download away from the agency, and he was looking for an excuse to shut down the agency itself. He got that excuse when Dr. Jennifer Stone, for reasons of personal animosity, came to him with allegations of an extensive cover-up of security violations at the project. For the record, I should point out that her story was not entirely without some truth, but that it was grossly exaggerated and blown out of proportion, largely because it suited Carmen's purposes.
But why would Senator Carman allege that you had malfunctioned, that you had gone insane the same way Stalker did?
Because it would get me out of the way and give him a clear field to pull off his political power play. And unwittingly, I played right into his hands. I had been ordered to report to Project Headquarters, but I did not because I was engaged in following up a personal investigation of some significance. Senator Carman used my failure to report in as an excuse to exaggerate the situation, claiming that I had not reported in because I had started to malfunction, and that Oliver Higgins and Dr. Devin Cooper, senior officials on the project, were conspiring to cover that up in order to protect their funding. Dr. Stone, with a personal axe to grind, backed him up on these claims.
If that's the case, then why did Oliver Higgins and Dr. Cooper go on the run instead of confronting the charges against them? Asked Linda. And why did you resist arrest?
Higgins knew that the order had gone out to use whatever force was necessary to bring me in, Steele replied. He realized that if I was brought in, I could obviously prove that there was nothing whatsoever wrong with me. However, I wouldn't be able to prove that if I was placed on downtime and dismantled. So he and Cooper tried to warn me. Unfortunately, I ran into the federal marshals first when I came home. Initially, I did not resist arrest. I had no idea why they were arresting me. I thought it was all some sort of mistake and was perfectly willing to go along quietly so that it could be cleared up. But from some remarks made to me by the arresting officers, I realized that something was very wrong. I asked to call Oliver Higgins in an attempt to clarify the situation and was told that he was facing charges as well. That seemed hard to believe, and when I asked for an explanation, they refused to tell me any more. At that point, I began to doubt that they were actually federal marshals. There had been some rather elaborate attempts made against my life before, and I was starting to suspect that this could be yet another one. Then I saw a fellow agent whom they had also taken into custody and brutalized for reasons that weren't clear. He saw me and urged me to make a break for it. The minute I did, they opened fire.
And that was when you were forced to kill those marshals? Linda asked.
I returned their fire, Steele replied. But I went to great lengths not to hit anyone. And you know what pinpoint accuracy I'm capable of.
Then who shot those five men who died at the scene?
She asked. That was my partner, Ice, and a gypsy cab driver named Slim, who'd worked with us before on several occasions, said Steele. They arrived on the scene, saw me running, carrying an injured fellow agent, and being fired upon, and they responded accordingly. There wasn't time to ask a lot of questions. I'm not trying to justify what they did, but they were being shot at too. In any case, they're both dead now, murdered when federal marshals assaulted the Borodini Enclave, which, as you know, has been under agency control ever since we drove the Borodinis out.
So then you were actually present during the assault on the Enclave when Oliver Higgins and Dev Cooper, together with their men, were killed resisting arrest?
She asked. That's an outright lie! Said Steele. They did not resist arrest. The media reported that there was a furious firefight that lasted for 3 hours. Not a word of that is true. That so-called firefight was staged by the marshals expressly for the benefit of the TV news cameras after Oliver Higgins and the others had surrendered. I personally heard Oliver Higgins ordering his people not to fire on the federal officers under any circumstances. Dr. Devin Cooper in particular was anxious to turn himself in, because they had access to all the pertinent information and could reveal the truth. Carmen couldn't let that happen. So after Higgins, Cooper, and the others had surrendered, they were all executed on Carmen's orders.
You're actually accusing Senator Bryce Carmen of murder?
Linda asked.
I'm accusing him of ordering those executions, yes! For no other reason than to allow him to pull off a political power play. Because I know the truth, he's fabricated this entire story about me malfunctioning and running amok. Because with Oliver Higgins and Devin Cooper dead, if I'm killed, that leaves no one else around to implicate him.
That's an astonishing allegation, Linda said. Have you any proof of these incredible charges?
At this point, I'm afraid it's just my word against his, replied Steele. And I'm under no illusion as to who seems more credible. But I'll get the proof, believe me. Doing this interview with you was only the first step. I wanted the people to see for themselves that I'm not insane or out of control. I'm not experiencing any malfunctions whatsoever. There's nothing wrong with me. The truth is that the only person I'm a threat to is Bryce Carmen.
He looked directly into the camera.
And I'm going to get the goods on you, you bastard. I'm going to see you go to jail for what you've done. Count on it.
For Eyewitness News, this is Linda Tellerman reporting.
She made the cut sign.
Wow, Andy, did you get all that?
I got it,
Andy said, lowering the minicam and exhaling heavily.
Jesus, that stuff's dynamite.
We're not going to edit a thing, she said. We're going on the air with that at 6, as is.
I'll be watching, Steele said.
What are you going to do now?
She asked.
Stay low, said Steele. Keep out of sight until this story airs, and then I'm going to turn myself into Jake Hardesty.
No, that would be a serious mistake. You mustn't do that, Linda said with concern. At least, not yet.
Why not? Jake can make sure I'll get a fair hearing.
He may want to, but he won't be able to,
she replied.
Face it, all you've got right now are some wild accusations. You've made them sound convincing, but you're still wanted for murder. You can't prove you're innocent.
I don't have to prove I'm innocent, said Steele. They have to prove I'm guilty.
Get real, she said. Your brain is a computer, and computers have no civil rights. The minute you turn yourself in, they'll cut you off. Let me work with you on this. I'll broadcast the story. I'll get this whole town talking, asking questions, demanding answers from Bryce Carmen. I'll get the heat turned up. Meanwhile, you get me that proof against him, and we'll nail his ass to the wall.
Okay, I'll try it your way, Steele said. Without the media and the people behind me, I haven't got a prayer anyway.
I'll be behind you all the way on this, she said. How do I get in touch with you?
You don't. I'll get in touch with you.
Yes, you're right. That way, if anything happens, I can swear under oath that I had no idea where you were or how to reach you. They won't be able to charge me with being an accessory, and I'll be free to put the pressure on.
Thanks, Linda.
I appreciate that. Hey, listen, I should be thanking you, she said. You've just handed me the hottest story of my career.
Just be very careful, Steele said. Carmen's got a lot of influence. He's a bad one to cross.
She smiled. So am I. Call me later, and I'll let you know how it went over.
I will, and thanks again. You took a big chance coming to meet me. I appreciate that.
He turned and started to walk away.
Steele,
he turned. Take care of yourself, she said.
You too.
They got back into their car.
Jesus, what a story, Linda said, euphoric. The most powerful man in Congress, accused of murder and corruption. Hot damn. So you still think we stuck our necks out, Andy?
No,
said Andy.
But we're about to.
End of prologue.